14. Uncivil Wars. The year Quanah became a warrior, 1863, was the bloodiest year in American history, though most of the blood that was shed had nothing at all to do with this ambitious Comanche boy who rode free on the western plains, stealing horses and taking scalps. The agent of death and destruction was the Civil War. That year, it was transformed forever from the relatively brief, self-contained, regional conflict most people believed it would be, into the malevolent, drawn-out, continent-girding affair that threatened to rip the country permanently apart. 1863 was the year of Chancellorsville and Chickamauga, of Vicksburg and Chattanooga, the year Robert E. Lee marched 75,000 rebel troops clear into Pennsylvania, into the great heartland of the North, where they fought the Union to a grisly 51,000 casualty draw at Gettysburg. The Civil War had very little to do with the Western frontier itself. All of its main engagements took place east of the Mississippi River, and such action as there was in Texas, Kansas, New Mexico, and the Indian Territory did not involve the free horse tribes. Still, the war managed to tear that frontier apart. It did so not with armies of men and rolling caissons, but with simple neglect. Preoccupied with the war, and in any case lacking the money to fight Indians, federal and Confederate governments alike had no choice but to leave the West to its own devices. That meant that, quite suddenly, most of the people who had defended the borderlands in the 1840s and 1850s, from the Rangers to the 2nd Cavalry to various state militias, were simply gone. The men who won victories with Ford at Antelope Hills, or Van Dorn at Wichita Village, or Ross at Pease River, all departed for eastern battlefields. And with them went the knowledge and will to pursue Comanches into their homelands. In their place rose the state and territorial militias, a sorry lot of inferior soldiers commanded by substandard officers who were ducking the larger war. They were under-equipped as well. They provided their own, often atrocious, weapons. Their lead was in short supply, and some of their powder was so poor that it would not kill a man 10 steps from the muzzle. They suffered from bad food, alcoholism, epidemics of measles and intestinal ills, and in any event were neither brave enough nor smart enough to win fights with Comanches or Cheyennes or Kiowas. One regiment, embarking on an Indian pursuit, decided instead to head to another fort and play poker. They were preoccupied with other concerns anyway, which included their own miniaturized version of the war. In 1861, the Texas militia moved into Indian Territory, occupied federal forts, and drove the Union troops north into the brand new state of Texas. There would be periodic small-scale fighting over the territory for the duration of the war, culminating in the Battle of Honey Springs in 1863, in which 3,000 Union troops from Kansas defeated 6,000 Texans and Indians. But these events took place well east of the frontier, which remained ignored and undefended. And this sudden neglect changed everything. Though the bizarrely passive federal policies of the 1850s had opened the way for hundreds of Indian attacks, the decade had in fact closed with a flash of willpower and resolve. Rip Ford's 1858 expedition was a watershed event with few precedents, including what the only Spanish governor to rein in Comanche terror, the brilliant Don Juan Bautista de Anza, had done in his pursuit of Cuerno Verde onto the plains of eastern Colorado in 1779. And while Sol Ross's victory at Pease River in 1860 may not have been quite as glorious as most histories suggest, as a measure of the Taibo's will to defend themselves, it too was a conspicuous advance. Indeed, it would have seemed in the late 1850s, as it had seemed in the late 1830s and the late 1840s, that Comanche power was fast on the wane, that their ability to raid unchallenged would soon come to an end, that their days off the reservation were sharply numbered. And yet all that was an illusion. Comanche history must be understood that way, in terms of pulses and counterpulses of power. The pulse of state and federal power in the late 1850s was awesome. Comanches were running for shelter in the fastness of the Llano Estacado. They would soon have been broken. There were not enough of them left for it to be otherwise. Then the Civil War came, the Texans went off to fight it, and they left their bones in shallow graves all over the South, and the lesson was forgotten again. What is remarkable, in retrospect, is how long it took the Comanches to figure out that border defenses had lapsed, how long it took them to grasp this massive shift in the balance of power. This was partly because both the Union and Confederacy, equally enfeebled in their western zones, were quick to pursue generous new treaties with them. The resulting agreements were versions of the same tired, disingenuous, and ultimately useless promises, but they did delay the inevitable reckoning. The Confederates promised the people gifts and supplies. In exchange, the Indians cheerfully agreed to settle on their reservation, learn how to farm, and stop attacking both white and red people, promises they had no intention of keeping. The treaty was signed by the Comanches who lived on the reservation, mainly Penaticas, as well as the chiefs of the wild Comanche bands, including the Nokoni, Yamparica, Kotsotika, and a remnant of the Tenawish. The Quahadis, magnificently aloof as always, refused to sign anything. The federal government made its own treaty too, one that simply restated the Treaty of 1853, promising the same old annuities and provisions, asking for the same sort of absurd concessions. The first of the horrors to be unleashed by the demon of neglect had little to do with the white man. These were the Indian-on-Indian wars in the Indian Territory, the land north of the Red River and south of Kansas that would eventually become the state of Oklahoma. Most of the conquered and displaced tribes from the East, South, and Midwest had been relocated there, a process that had begun in the early 19th century. In 1830, Congress passed the Indian Removal Act, which forced most tribes to give up all of their lands in the East and Midwest for a supposedly eternal plot of ground in the Indian Territory. By the 1860s, the territory had become an intricate patchwork of aboriginal cultures, each with its own designated reserve. The larger reserves had been given to the five civilized tribes, Creek, Choctaw, Cherokee, Chickasaw, and Seminole, as well as to the combined Comanche, Kiowa, and Apache tribes, the Cheyennes and Arapahoes, and to the Wichitas and their affiliated tribes, Caddoes, Anadarkos, Tonkawas, Tawakonees, Kichais, and Delawares. There were smaller areas for Kickapoos, Sac and Fox, Osages, Pawnees, Potawatomies and Shawnees, Iowas, Peorias, Quapaws, Modocs, Ottawas, Wyandots, Senecas, Poncas, and Otoes and Missouris. It was, all in all, an astonishing collision of native interests and antagonisms, all jammed together by fiat of Congress on the rolling plains and timberlands north of the Red River. For many of these tribes, the Civil War was as much of a disaster as it became, eventually, for white farmers in eastern Georgia. The trouble began in 1861, soon after the first shots of the war were fired, when the United States withdrew its troops from Indian Territory. Though there were a few ragtag Confederates scattered through the territory, the agrarian tribes were mostly unprotected from the wild horse tribes, who had always hated them for encroaching on their hunting grounds and for what they saw as their fawning accommodation of the white man. With no one to offer the farming tribes even nominal protection, the Comanches unleashed a terrible violence. These were mostly the wild bands, but the Penaticas from the reservation sometimes rode with them. The Chickasaws were the principal target, though other tribes also fell victim. Comanches raided their farms and settlements just as they raided on the Texas frontier. They rode down upon their foot-bound, house-dwelling, field-tilling victims. Many Chickasaws were driven out of the Indian Territory altogether and into Kansas. Choctaws and Creeks came under Comanche attack too, as did the Indians of the Wichita Reservation, some of whom had copied the settled agrarian ways of the civilized tribes with great success. Comanches made short work of their farms, stock, and crops. Whole settlements were butchered, captives taken. It should be noted that the civilized Indians were not always easy prey. They were often capable fighters, and sometimes they got the better of their tormentors. But Comanche raids were just part of the tragedy. There were also partisan wars between the entrenched tribes. There were Confederate Indians and Union Indians. Many members of the five civilized tribes were slaveholders, which both angered Union Indians and caused deep rifts within their own ranks. The result was a series of massacres and retaliations, most of which are lost to history. What is known about them suggests that they were brutal and widespread. Cherokee, Creek, and Seminole territories became the scenes of battles between loyalists on both sides. Houses and farms were burned. Seed stock and farming tools destroyed or stolen. Large segments of those tribes ended the war hungry and destitute, dependent once again upon the government for their livelihood. In 1862, 100 Tonkawas were killed in a single attack, part of a wave of such incidents that nearly resulted in their extermination. This was ostensibly because of their cannibalism, which the other tribes deplored, but it was more likely because they had long served the Texans as scouts in their anti-Indian expeditions. The Civil War offered many such opportunities for settling scores. As in the larger war, there were massive displacements of human beings. In late 1861, a large body of loyal Creeks and other tribes, under the command of Creek chief Apothle Yohola, were attacked repeatedly in the last week of December by a combination of Confederate tribes and Texas cavalry. The terrified Union Indians dropped everything and fled northward. Large numbers of them froze in the bitter cold, and many of their bodies were eaten by wolves. Babies were born naked on the snow and soon died of exposure. According to one report, 700 Creeks and others were either killed in the attacks or froze to death. Once in Kansas, they gathered in a refugee camp where things were scarcely better. Families slept on the frozen ground with only scraps of cloth, handkerchiefs, aprons, and such, stretched on saplings as protection against the plains blizzards. The initial composition of that camp reveals much about what the Civil War did to the Indian territory. It contained 3,168 Creeks, 53 Creek slaves, 38 free Creek Negroes, 777 Seminoles, 136 Quapaws, 50 Cherokees, 31 Chickasaws, and a few Kickapoos. By April, the camp held 7,600 refugees that included Quechuas, Hainais, Biloxis, and Caddos, all of them utterly dispossessed of everything they once owned. As the war raged in the east, the white frontier exploded into its own nightmare of killing. The outbreaks had their origins in the north in 1862, with an Indian revolt on the prairie plains of Minnesota. That year, the Santee Sioux, the Eastern Sioux, also known as Dakota, rose up in rebellion from their reservation along the Minnesota River. They killed as many as 800 white settlers, the highest civilian wartime toll in U.S. history prior to 9/11. They made another 40,000 into refugees, who fled eastward in full mortal panic. The violence was extreme, almost mindless, spurred in part by the failure of the federal government to deliver annuities and supplies, and in part by the absence of government troops. Unlike the Texans, most of whom came from pioneer stock and understood the atrocities of Indian and especially Comanche warfare, these Minnesotans were simple yeoman farmers. Most were from Europe. Their reaction was hysterical fear, which only became worse when they experienced what the northern settlers had not yet encountered, the calculated rape and torture of female captives. When Bluecoat volunteers finally crushed the Santee Rebellion, angry mobs screamed at the captives in their cages, castrated the few they got a hold of, and demanded that the rebels be executed. If President Lincoln had not stepped in, hundreds would have died that way. As it was, 38 were hanged, the largest one-day execution in American history. The following year, the tribe was expelled from Minnesota, their reservations abolished. At long last, the Sioux, the great power of the North, were finally colliding with the advancing line of settlements, something that had been happening in Texas since the 1820s.